May it please the Court. My name is Steve Maurer. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Respondent, the City of Harrisonville, Missouri. There are four issues for the Court this morning, two raised by Appellant, two raised by the Defendant Respondent, PSTIF, the Petroleum Storage Tank Insurance Fund. The two issues raised by the City of Harrisonville are, one, does the statutory cap set against punitive damages set forth in Chapter 510-265 apply to the punitive damages of $8 million awarded to the City of Harrisonville against the fund? And secondly, did the Circuit Court properly remit the City's $8 million punitive damage award to $2.5 million? The two issues raised by the fund in its appeal are, first, whether the City properly proved its claim for fraud, and the specific issue is whether the City had evidence of detrimental reliance. And the second issue is whether the fund is immune or cannot pay the claim for punitive damages. Those are the four issues. And unless the Court has a preference, I'll start with my first.
How do you get around the bond case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the bond case?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with what you're talking about on the bond case.
The Vaughn case.
Oh, Vaughn.
I'm sorry, mispronouncing it.
I apologize. I thought you said bond. The bond case, Your Honor, is very clear. Vaughn involved a statutory created cause of action. Vaughn involved the service letter statute. Vaughn was not a common law cause of action like fraud. Unlike Vaughn, this case is controlled by the most recent pronouncement of this court in Llewellyn versus Chad Franklin and National Auto Sales. In Llewellyn, this court found that the statutory cap was specifically unconstitutional if the cause of action asserted was that by a party was one that would have had the right to a jury trial in 1820 when the Constitution was adopted. If so, the right to a jury trial was inviolate, and the jury's ability to rule on and grant a verdict on punitive damages was inviolate.
And the parties
did you preserve the issue, or did you? One of the allegations by your opposing counsel was that you waived the issue of the jury trial because you didn't raise it, the constitutional issue, early enough.
We absolutely preserved this issue, Your Honor, for three reasons. First, under Llewellyn case, this court ruled that the application of 510-265 is unconstitutional. When the court declares a statute unconstitutional, it is gone. It is void. It is void ab initio. It cannot be applied. In two cases.
Well, there's issues about whether it applies retroactively, but you're saying this case had just been tried and was on, it was not in a post-appeal status. It was still on direct appeal at that time.
Yes.
Still on the trial court, actually.
Yes, Your Honor. Here, in our case, much like in Lieber versus Heil in 1932, the court had entered a judgment based on a statute. The appeal had been taken while the appeal was pending. The court declared in another case that the statute was unconstitutional, and then on appeal the court said, based on that ruling, the statute is void, it's as if it never existed, and it is gone. Therefore, in that case, the party appealing based on the unconstitutional statute won because it was as if the statute never existed. Similarly, most recently in State versus Hudson, Mr. Hudson was convicted of a statutory violation. Why he was already judgment entered against him, but while his appeal was pending on direct appeal, the statute for his violation was ruled unconstitutional. Then the Court of Appeals said, well, there cannot be a violation of an unconstitutional statute, even though there was already judgment entered. It was therefore reversed. Mr. Hudson went free. This is exactly the scenario we have today. We are still on appeal. There has been no full and final ruling on our case. This court has declared in Llewellyn that 510-265 cannot be applied, and I think I've got the quote down, if a party bringing a claim for fraud had the right to a trial by jury. That's our claim. We brought a claim for fraud. It is on four corners with Llewellyn versus National Auto Sales. We have exactly the same scenario. We are on appeal. The case has been declared, the statute as applied to us has been declared unconstitutional. We win. There is no dispute about it being a void and unconstitutional statute as it applies to Harrisonville. Secondly, the reason why we've preserved this argument is because the court can affirm the decision of the lower court for any reason. That's Gattos versus Imhoff. In that case, the court found that even though it wasn't an argument advanced to the trial court, because the trial court ruled in favor of the party advancing the argument, as a result, the court could look at any reason that was supported by the record. Here, we won in the circuit court. The circuit court found that the statute 510-265 did not apply to the city of Harrisonville, but for a different reason.
Isn't the reason we require preservation so that the trial court gets the first shot at all the issues? And that would it make very much sense if you had three winners in your pocket to just raise one and have the case go up on appeal and then raise the other two? Why wouldn't it be a more fair application of the first opportunity rule to require both sides to always bring all their claims so that the idea is we have one fair trial and one appeal of these cases?
Two answers, Your Honor. First, because in this case, the court ruled the statute didn't apply. When the court makes a determination on statutory construction and statutory enforcement, the circuit court, would have never gotten to the unconstitutional issue and never declared a statute unconstitutional if in the first instance it said the statute did not apply. Therefore, there is no lost opportunity of the circuit court to say, wait a minute, I should have had a chance to rule. The court would have never reached that issue in the first place because the statute didn't apply. Secondly, in this case, the premise for our appeal on this constitutional issue was this court's pronouncement in Watts versus Lester Cox Medical Center. That case did not come down until after the trial court decision was done. We were on appeal when the Watts case came down. As the court noted in Hepson versus Sanderson, the requirement to raise the constitutional issue is at the first opportunity. The first opportunity that we had to raise this issue is when we did. And in fact,
when you make a claim for punitive damages and you think that the cap to punitive damages is unconstitutional, why wouldn't your first opportunity be in your petition?
Because we had a claim for punitive damages, and in response to the answer, the defendants never asserted 510-265. I can't anticipate and be required to assert, oh, and by the way, if they raise this defense, then I'm going to assert that it's unconstitutional. 510-265 was never raised by them, by the defendants, in their answer. In fact, the constitutionality and due process concerns that they now present to the court were never raised at all. They never addressed in their answer, in a motion to dismiss, in a motion for summary judgment, or a motion at all before judgment, any of these issues. In fact, they didn't raise any issue involving 510-265 until a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, which occurred much, much later than after the trial and the verdict. Therefore, in my answer, there was no reason to assert it because they hadn't raised it. And I can't be required as the plaintiff to foreshadow and guess at what they might assert and then attempt to rebut it. So for those reasons, I don't believe that we were required to do that. I see my time is growing short, and I'd really like to get to the waiver issue if I might. In this case, the circuit court, on her own, sua sponte, remitted our verdict from $8 million to $2.5 million. Now, before the court, the PSTIF asserts that that was done pursuant to 537-068. I only invite the court to look at the legal file beginning at page 553, which is the judgment by Judge Cook, the circuit court judge, on that issue. She did not rule on 537-068. In fact, she specifically found that 537-068 would not apply because, as this court has announced, in the Batom case, in order to reach the remitter issue under 537-068, you'd have to first find that there was a new trial to be granted. Judge Cook specifically found that there was no right to a new trial, that there was no basis for a new trial, and that JNOV on all grounds was denied. What she did do is sua sponte raise the due process issue as set forth by the United States Supreme Court in the State Farm case and its progeny about excessive punitive damages. Her opinion even says she is doing it sua sponte.
She did not in the alternative. She did not say remitted to her or you get a new trial because that's you're required to.
She did not grant us a new trial. So what she did is instead of using 537.068, she went straight to due process and said that this verdict should be remitted from $8 million to $2.5
million. But still, doesn't this punitive damage award violate the due process remitter, the State Farm case of a single-digit multiplier?
It does not, Your Honor, because State Farm, first of all, did not establish a hard-line rule on single-digit multipliers. Secondly, their basis for the circuit court's decision was nothing in line with the State Farm requirements. In State Farm and in Gore, the Supreme Court of the United States established three guideposts for determining the applicability of punitive damages. And the first guidepost is reprehensibility of conduct. There is no analysis at all in the circuit court decision regarding reprehensible conduct.
Well, if you get into that, though, aren't we to assume that all facts are found in accordance with the trial court's judgment, where neither party requested any sort of findings relative to the due process analysis? Wouldn't we be bound to assume that all facts were found in accordance with the trial court's judgment under 7301?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because in this case, she's acting under due process, and due process is something she did sua sponte. And therefore, and this court and the Missouri Courts of Appeals have said many, many times, including the Perez versus Taylor case, that the court cannot raise it sua sponte. The court cannot plow through the record, find some sort of constitutional infirmity, and then become the lawyer for one of the litigants. In this case,
isn't there a difference for a trial judge? Isn't there a difference between becoming an advocate and thinking that you're constitutionally required to remit a verdict to ensure that there's one trial based upon due process considerations, whether either party raises it?
I see my time is up. May I answer that question, Your Honor?
Please do.
Your Honor, I don't believe so, because in this case, this court has said many times, including Hollis versus Blevins, a constitutional issue like due process has to be raised at the earliest opportunity, also has to be raised with specificity, also has to have specific facts setting forth what the constitutional infirmity involves. None of that was done in this case. Therefore, it's waived. And the court cannot, sua sponte, give back to a party an argument that was waived. Nowhere in their pleadings, nowhere in their motions, prior to judgment, did they ever raise due process. In fact,
after the judgment was entered, or after the jury came back with $8 million, did they then say this was too great, that the amount was a violated due process?
Not until their motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. And that was a motion for a new trial.
Well, why did they have, they didn't know what the jury would come back with, so how could they know to say it was too high until they saw what the jury came back with?
Your Honor, they could have raised in their answer the issue of, because we certainly sought punitive damages, and in Hollins versus Blevins, the court said the earliest opportunity to raise them.
But just as, it's very interesting reading the two briefs, because both of you say the other one didn't raise something early enough that really didn't become an issue in the case until the verdict came back. I understand that, but just as you're making the argument that then we're going to raise the cap as a defense, there's no reason why you should raise it. Why isn't the comparable true that until the jury came back with a verdict that was many times higher, they had no obligation to say it would be to anticipate they do that and say, and if they do this, that would be unconstitutional?
Even if you grant them that one, Your Honor, even if you give them that, in their motion for JNOV, they did not raise due process. The only thing they did is in one head point, when discussing Section 510.265, they threw in the phrase right after 510.265, comma, and violates state and federal due process standards, comma, and went on. That was it. No citation to due process of Article Amendment 14, no citation to the Missouri Constitution, and certainly no discussion of facts. And in Bresnoff versus City of St. Louis, this court very clearly said that's not good enough. It is waived. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Mr. Bradford represents McCall and Fleming, who had this service station at various times in Harrisonville, where there was a tank that leaked. Their verdicts against those two entities for $172,000. And there are issues beyond those raised by the fund in its briefs that have been addressed in the brief on behalf of McCall and Fleming. It's not my intention to address those, but if the court has questions, we can ask Mr. Bradford. My role, I think this is a first for me, despite my years of representing the state, is to stand here and represent a fund. It's as if I were standing here representing the statewide court automation fund. I'm here representing a fund in the state treasury, not the managers of that fund, not the board of trustees of that fund, not if I were doing the automation fund, I wouldn't be here for OSCA or for the court automation committee, I'd just be here for the fund. Ultimately, the question here is whether $8 million should move out of that fund into the coffers of the city of Harrisonville to use as they will, rather than remain in the fund to be used to clean up pollution in the state of Missouri. There are 2 points I'd like to emphasize. The first is that the city failed to prove an element of fraud, and the second is that Llewellyn does not apply, and the punitive damages cap, assuming there can be punitive damages here, applies. Let me first look at the proof at trial. With regard to detrimental reliance, there's proof that the city needed a new sewer, proof that construction was stopped when they encountered pollution in the course of constructing that sewer. They then needed, as soon as possible, a qualified contractor to deal with that pollution. They looked at 2 offers. They took the lower price, and the work was timely and satisfactorily completed. So where's the detrimental reliance? Well, the city says that it is in that there could have been more soil removed. And they refer to an offhand remark by one of their witnesses that it might have cost $500,000 to remove all the polluted soil in the right-of-way that the city owns. Actually, there's a little bit more specific evidence in the record. The city, after the fact, demanded $446,000 from the fund. And it did so because it was trying to also get what it would cost to remove soil from areas from an area where the city in the future might build a sewer line.
But council, their argument basically is that they thought they were entitled to up to $500,000, but to have money from the fund to remediate the entire site, all the pollution. But a bird in hand, your client promised, we're not going to contest it. If you take this this person who we think is good at remediating, and they'll remediate the part you need for this sewer line, we'll pay it. And so rather than have a contested issue, which they ended up having for $500,000, they took the bird in hand, sure money up front, and they could have their sewer line done right away, and that was their reliance, and that was to their detriment.
But they gave up nothing. Because they still...
Well, they gave up many years and contaminated soil in return for something they thought was a sure remedy paid for that they didn't get, is their claim. And why wasn't that a fact?
Because they got what they were trying to get, which was a remediated area for this sewer line. What they didn't give up was the $273,000 for the additional area that they, as their own witness agreed, took off the table. They could do that another day.
Well, but they haven't done it now. They gave up asking for it then in return for the agreement to clean up the part they needed for the sewer line.
Well,
they're
actually...
Saying, and whether or not... I'm not going to what I think or would find, but that's the reliance that they allege, and why wasn't that adequate if believed to support?
Well, it's reliance, but where's the detriment?
Because the detriment is it's 5 years later and they still have contaminated soil.
That 5 years later, excuse me?
And they still have contaminated soil. It's not...
No, they don't have contaminated soil on the area that that they were dealing with at the time. They have it on the other areas, but they never demanded, except for after the fact in the negotiation with the fund and McCall and Fleming, they raised the ante, in essence, and said, well, there's this other stuff that we may want to get out at some point. And then they took that off the table. So that's still out there. And they still could get that if they build the sewer out there at some point. But they haven't given that up. They've given up nothing. And so there is no detrimental reliance in this case.
So that was raised in a motion for summary judgment, right?
Not that I recall, Your
Me
Honor.
Neither.
I don't recall there being a motion for summary judgment on that point.
Me neither.
Was that part of their original negotiations? Before they entered into the deal for...
No, that was discussion after the fact, not before.
They didn't up front say, we got all this contaminated soil, come in here and help us figure this out and pay for it?
There is nothing in the transcript, in the record, to show that that's what they were asking
Why is the $500,000 figure for taking care of all the soil in the record then?
Well, the $500,000 figure is when someone said, okay, if you took all the soil out
exactly.
from the right-of-way,
yes.
that what might that cost? And their witness said, well, it could be $100,000, it could be $500,000.
And that's what they're saying the detrimental reliance is, that they didn't go that way. Instead, they went on what they thought was the sure thing of doing just the sewer lines.
But again, they haven't. They still can go that way, so they haven't given anything up.
Counselor?
Yes.
Do you agree that our cases hold that you have to cite the constitutional provision, both the U.S. constitutional provision and the state constitutional provision, in order to preserve a constitutional argument?
I have to agree to that for reasons independent of this particular case. But let me turn to the cap on punitive damages to which the questions of notice are relevant. To apply Llewellyn, this court would have to hold for the very first time that cities have a constitutional jury trial right. In the reply brief, the city for the first time makes the claim that there is such a right for cities, and it goes back to 1820, which I'll address in just a moment. They cite early cases from Missouri saying that all parties have a jury trial right. But like as this court's language in Llewellyn, the language in those cases is broad language that does not take into consideration that there may be and, in fact, are differentiations among types of plaintiffs, including subdivisions of the state of Missouri.
Well, what about their argument that when we recognize the right to jury trial and we talk about the right to jury trial as it existed, we say it's to the type of action, not to the type of injury alleged. So when we said there was a right to jury trial in employment cases, it's not that there was an employment law statute or there were employment cases, but you were suing for a personal injury for which you had a right to jury trial, and that here you're trying to tie it down to a particular type of plaintiff or a particular statutory claim, whereas really it's a tort claim or a contract claim, and either of those were subject to jury trial.
Because we want to hold you to the words you just spoke, Your Honor.
Okay.
We're talking about a claim that you have, a person has.
And that the fund does define person very broadly to include municipal corporations and political subdivisions.
I don't follow that.
The statute uses the word person very broadly, defines it very broadly to include every type of entity as well as any.
Well, the question is, assuming that you go back to 1820, which I think the court is absolutely wrong in doing, assuming you go back to 1820, the question is, would a subdivision of the state of Missouri prior to the adoption of the Constitution, so this is before there was any subdivision of the state of Missouri, would that subdivision have had a jury trial right?
But that's my question to you, is why is that the question? Opposing counsel says that's not the question.
But
he says the question is the type of claim I'm bringing one for which you had a right to jury trial? If so, then I get it.
So what he's claiming is that when the people in 1945 voted for the Constitution, that they were thinking that, okay, here's someone who doesn't have a jury trial right today because, for example, there is no cause of action here, but that somehow because the courts in 1820 said, well, everyone has a jury trial right, that means they were reinstating a prior jury trial right. Well, there's no way to read the 1945 Constitution to do that. The question really has to be, when the people voted in 1945, what was the jury trial right that existed heretofore? That is, was there a jury trial right that the city of Harrisonville
could assert? So you would have us overrule all our cases saying we look at the right to jury trial in 1920?
Yes, because I cannot understand why it is that the people in 1945 could be alleged to have supposed that the question, for example, of the constitutionality of the workers' comp statute, which had been in place for 20 years, was now going to be judged not according to what the people understood in 1945, but according to what someone understood 125 years before.
And if we don't do that, does that affect your
no,
argument?
No, it does not, because in 1945 and 1920, or 1820 both, there is no right of the cities to have a jury trial. The city, of course, didn't exist. I mean, the city of Harrisonville, there were no subdivisions of the state of Missouri in 1820, so there is no authority out there to say that.
You know,
the
they
city
made that argument in to the U.S. Supreme Court when they said corporations weren't people because there weren't corporations then, but somehow corporations are people. Is that an analogous situation?
Well, I don't think it is, because the question is only whether in 1945 the people retained a jury trial right, not expanded it, but retained it. So the question is, what was the jury trial right? And although this court, in cases like Llewellyn, has defined it broadly, no one has come to this court to date and said, wait a minute, the question isn't just the type of the cause of action. The question is this a plaintiff or a defendant where there would be a jury trial right? And did the people in 1945 expand the right beyond where it existed before that day?
And I'm sorry, because we've been on these site issues, you all disagree as to whether cities had that right at that time?
Yes.
And your argument is cities did not have that right?
Right. There's no evidence the cities had that right. And in fact, again, it doesn't, if you're looking at 1820, it doesn't, as a logical matter, there's no way to show that they had that right because there were no subdivisions of the state of Missouri prior to 1820.
The courts held that cities don't have due process rights,
right,
or equal protection rights that otherwise apply to persons or even corporations.
And no retrospective law rights, which is pertinent here.
And is there any reason then to think that the Pistiff has due process rights?
Well, I will agree that that's a problem, that if you're going to say that these entities have constitutional rights, then we get to assert a due process right. That seems really odd that a fund in the state treasury would have a due process right. And in the trial court, that may explain why the very first page of the motion for a new trial or for judgment outstanding the verdict begins by saying the court shall grant remittitor under section 537.068. And of course, what the court did in its order, despite what Mr. Maurer says, is it says expressly that it granted that motion. It granted the motion, and that's the motion as it was phrased. It was a motion under the statute. There is reference in there to due process, though.
Okay. If so, was the plaintiff given an opportunity to have a new trial?
As and phrased, no, it was not, and so that would...
Well, if you cite the statute, surely everything goes along with it.
And so in that case, maybe the trial court was wrong and it needs to go back for a new trial. That's not the relief that the plaintiffs have asked for.
Is there... there is a statute that gives persons, as defined, claims against the fund for to recoup the expenses of remediation.
Mr. Bradford's clients have a right under the statute as participants in the statute.
Is there any statute that says you could sue the fund for its own malfeasance or fraud or tortious conduct?
No more than there is for the State Court Automation Fund. Or a variety of other funds that come from special collections and are used for special purposes. No.
Well, if you're defrauded by people who work at the Pistiff office, then who do you sue to get your remedy?
Well, presumably, and this actually shows up in a couple of the prior Pistiff cases, you should sue either the Board of Trustees or the Executive Director, who is an employee of the state of Missouri, or both. But in this instance, the city of Harrisonville did not sue the Board of Trustees. It did not sue the executive director. It did not sue the agent who made the misrepresentation that was at issue here. It sued simply the fund in the state treasury.
So is it your position the fund can never be liable for punitive damages?
Yes. The fund has no authority to pay punitive damages.
Or actuals, you're saying. You're saying it can't be sued or be sued.
The fund... Well, I don't know if the fund could be sued independent of McCall and Fleming, because they are the ones whose liability the fund is authorized to pay, not its own liability, but their liability. And in this instance, we never really reached that question because they were named as parties.
If you sue the board or the fund managers or the employees, then the recovery would come out of legal expense.
Oh, presumably come out of legal expense.
And not Pistiff.
Right, right. Then it wouldn't come out of the pocket of the people of the state of Missouri. I mean, that's part of the problem with this case is that ultimately what we're talking about is taking $8 million that have been paid for a single purpose to clean up pollution in the state of Missouri and to turn it over to the city of Harrisonville so they can do with it whatever they want.
So it doesn't matter whether it's $8 million or $1 million or whatever.
It doesn't
matter. The fund shouldn't have to pay.
It doesn't matter. The fund should not have to pay.
And that was raised for the first time when?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I note that at this stage there are three ways of getting to that argument, however. You can take our approach, which is to say it never should have been submitted to the jury. You can take the plaintiff's approach saying that it's just wrong. Or you can say there really isn't a question that is ripe yet.
Well, if they asked for punitive damages and you didn't raise their inability to get them that you assert now in your answer, why isn't it waived?
Well, I don't know that it was in the answer. It was addressed at some point during the proceeding. It could be waived, but the board the fund can't waive. I mean, the problem there is that there's no way for the fund to waive it. The fund can't pay it no matter what happens.
But of course, if it had been raised, there might have been an amendment where trustees might have been added and so forth.
Possibly.
None of that was raised till now.
Possibly.
Is that fair to the plaintiff to let them go all the way through and then say there's nobody there? Or isn't that a waiver?
I can't be responsible for the decisions made by the plaintiff and his counsel.
And then one more thing. Can the fund sue, say, if for recouping remediation costs or for any other reason? Has the fund ever sued or can the fund sue?
I don't think the fund has sued. The fund only reimburses, that is, pays liability of its of the folks who are covered.
Aren't there cases where people have used the writ of mandamus in order to require a fund to pay a judgment?
Yes, there have been cases like that. And that's kind of the third approach here, is to say that whole question really comes up after the fact. Second injury fund cases are a bit like that, where we're talking about litigation kind of after the fact about whether or how an amount can actually be paid.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm going to try and address two quick things raised by opposing counsel. First, when was this issue that the fund can't pay raised, or that they can only pay certain amounts, or that they can only reimburse expenses of the insured? They filed a motion to dismiss. It's in the legal record on page 11. Right out of the box, they raised that issue and said, wait a minute, not us. That motion was denied, and then it was abandoned. There is nothing in their answer where they ever asserted the defense that we cannot pay. They never raised the issue anywhere prior to JNOV and then on appeal that somehow this should not have been tendered to the jury.
Assuming it was preserved, just assuming, mm-hmm. Address the merits of that point.
The merits of the point are very clear. Section 319 says it's very specific, that they cannot pay punitive damages as the result of the conduct of the insured. And it cannot be paid because of the conduct of the insured. It is very specific. It does not say that the fund can go out, commit any sorts of fraud that it wants, and be completely immune.
But that would be committed by the Board of Trustees or the Executive Director. It wouldn't be committed by the fund. It would be the liability of those employed or those working for the fund, wouldn't it?
Well, the fund only acts through its employees, and it acts through its board of directors. And it was the fund that promised to pay the city of Harrisonville. It was the fund that came up with the plan. Don't remove all the dirty soil. That will take $500,000. We'll bring in our guy. We'll put in a special pipe. It'll do the job, and it'll only cost $178,000.
Where in the statute is there authority to pay these claims? These specific claims by your client?
Where it is in the statute, Your Honor, is as in Hepson versus Sanderson. If you specifically state in the statute one thing, it is by intention then to exclude it from the other. And here, the legislature specifically said the fund cannot pay punitive damages for conduct of the insured. If, as the state is advancing, PSTIF is advancing, well, wait a minute, we can't pay anything but these specific things, those comments would be irrelevant and would be unnecessary. To construe the statute as a whole, as did the Court of Appeals, you have to find that by stating that we're not going to pay it for that, that means that there can be liability for its own tortious conduct.
Do you agree that if you had sued the board of director or the executive director for their tortious conduct, that would be paid out of a different fund, that you could have collected from the tort fund?
Your Honor, that is not an issue that has been raised anywhere. In fact, the entire brief on this point by PSTIF does not have on that point. Point two, doesn't have a single citation to the legal record where they advance that argument. In Gill Construction, I see my time is up. Can I answer that?
Go ahead.
In Gill Construction, this court said that in order to properly raise that issue and preserve it, you have to tender a jury instruction. Nowhere did PSTIF ever advance to the circuit court or to the Court of Appeals that, wait a minute, we're not the proper party. It's not us, it's the Board of Directors. It's not us, it's the state injury fund. That argument was never, ever raised until now. That argument is not before the court properly, and it's not one that I believe that we would have to address. But the answer is, I believe the fund is liable for its own conduct. And the legislature specifically said what it can pay on behalf of insureds. But just like most insurance policies, the insurance company, for its own bad faith, can be held liable for its own misconduct. And you don't read the exclusion in an insurance policy that says we won't pay for the insured's punitive conduct to exclude the bad faith conduct of the insurance company. And let there be no mistake, in opening arguments of our trial, PSTIF referred to itself as acting like an insurance company. In closing argument, it referred to
Counsel,
itself
thank you.
As an insurance
You're
company.
You're out of time. Thank you.
You.
The matter will be taken under submission.
Thank you.